From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today is the 50th anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Raphael Scharf. He's compiled a book of previously unpublished photographs of the ghetto taken by a German soldier in the summer of 1941. Scharf lost most of his family in the Holocaust and has dedicated much of his life to finding journals and pictures that document Jewish life during the war. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews a collection of essays and a collection of short stories by German author Christa Wolf. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate resumed debate today on the president's economic stimulus plan. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Returning to Washington after their Easter recess, senators prepared to discuss compromise amendments that might end the deadlock over the president's plan. Two will be offered tomorrow, one each by West Virginia Democrat Robert Byrd and Oregon Republican Mark Hatfield. The Byrd amendment would cut about 25% of the spending in the administration's $16 billion proposal. Senator Hatfield is expected to propose limiting the stimulus plan to 1 year, not the current two as proposed by the administration. Senator Hatfield said he is hopeful Republicans and Democrats can find common ground.
I do believe the time has come for both sides to move, and frankly, that's the sense I get from those Democratic colleagues of mine with whom I have had personal conversation.
The votes on the compromise amendments will be held Tuesday afternoon. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the Capitol.
Lawmakers are calling for a full investigation of today's federal attack on the Branch Davidian compound near Waco, Texas. Cult members apparently set the compound on fire, killing all but about eight of the more than 90 sect members inside, including sect leader David Koresh and 17 children. Attorney General Janet Reno said today that she approved the operation and took responsibility for it. FBI officials said they were trying to increase the pressure on the sect members when they battered the building walls with armored tanks and pumped tear gas inside. California Democrat Don Edwards, the chairman of the House subcommittee that oversees the FBI, said his panel is investigating. Operation Rescue founder Randall Terry demanded the resignation of Attorney General Reno, calling today's attack government terrorism against a religious group. There's a new development in the hostage standoff at a southern Ohio prison where inmates seized a cell block more than a week ago. Inmates are still holding five guards. For member station WOSU, Andrew Marceline reports.
The rioting prisoners at Lucasville, Ohio's maximum security penitentiary are willing to end their nine-day standoff. That's according to a sign delivered by inmates. Late this afternoon, prisoners in L Block hung a banner outside a window facing the media. The banner reads, "State lying to public, we're willing to end this ordeal. We want to talk face-to-face with our attorney." Last night, prison officials agreed to allow former ACLU attorney Nikki Schwartz to act as a legal advisor for the inmates. Schwartz has 20 years of experience arguing prisoners' rights, including overcrowding and race relations. Prison officials have yet to say whether Schwartz is at the prison or if he's even talking to the prisoners. For National Public Radio, I'm Andrew Marceline in Lucasville.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 12 points to close at 3,467. This is NPR. Secretary of State Warren Christopher said today that he expects the next round of Middle East peace talks to be delayed by no more than a week. The Palestinian delegation has been holding out, refusing to return to the talks until Israel allows nearly 400 exiled Palestinians to return to their homes in the occupied territories. A spokesman for the Palestine Liberation Organization said the Palestinians also want assurances that the future of East Jerusalem is negotiable. Scientists at the National Institutes of Health have begun the first-ever test of gene therapy to treat the disease cystic fibrosis. NPR's Joe Palca reports.
The scientists are trying to correct the genetic defect that causes cystic fibrosis, the most common fatal genetic disease in the United States. Approximately 30,000 people have the disease. The defect causes thick mucus to build up in the lungs, leading to infection and eventually irreversible lung damage. Now scientists believe they have found a way to give patients enough of the normal gene to treat the disease. Using genetic engineering, they hid copies of the normal gene in a deactivated cold virus. This weekend, doctors dripped the genetically engineered virus into the lungs of a 23-year-old cystic fibrosis patient. Right now, scientists are testing the therapy to be sure it's safe. Ultimately, they hope the therapy can be used in children to prevent the lung damage that typically causes death by age 30. In Washington, I'm Joe Palca.
Major air carriers announced today that they'll match a new round of spring and summer fare cuts offered by Northwest Airlines. The cuts amount to as much as 35% off on travels to most destinations in the United States before June 30th. United, American, and Delta said that effective immediately, they'd cut their fares in markets where they compete with Northwest. Last year's airfare wars cut deeply into airline revenues, and news of today's cuts triggered a sell-off in their shares. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is the 50th anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. After the Germans invaded Warsaw in 1939, all the Jews of the city, nearly 140,000 people, were herded into a Jewish neighborhood, which was later walled off from the rest of the city. Thousands of Jews in the ghetto died of starvation and disease. Thousands of others were sent to the gas chambers. 50 years ago today, when German soldiers came to destroy the ghetto and the remaining Jews, they were fought off by Jews with Molotov cocktails, stones, and handmade weapons. The Jews could never have won, but they heroically resisted the Germans for 3 weeks. My guest Raphael Scharf has edited a book of never-before-published photographs taken in the ghetto one summer day in 1941. Scharf is a Polish Jew who lost most of his family in the Holocaust. He lives in England, where he set up the Library of Holocaust Survivors. The pictures in his new book were taken by a German soldier named Willie George. Scharf tracked him down as soon as he heard about the photo's existence.
I found myself on the doorstep of the soldier photographer. I entered, accompanied by some of my friends, and it did in fact transpire that this gentleman whom I was facing in his own home, 50 years ago, almost to a day, entered the Warsaw Ghetto. Now, he was, by profession, a photographer. Hence, of course, the quality of the pictures that he took. Anyway, he entered the ghetto at about 10 o'clock in the morning, armed with his Leica, an early model, and started taking snapshots. Now, the landscape, the human landscape, which he found, was, of course, totally unexpected to him. He didn't quite understand what he was seeing, but it was so unusual and exotic that he took a great number of snaps.
Had this soldier been told to take pictures by his commander?
Can I expand at length? Have we got time to tell you? During the war, I was in the British Army in the intelligence corps, and my task was interrogating German prisoners of war. Now, when I found myself face to face with a former German soldier, all my antennae started vibrating. Now, I knew more about the scene than he did. Now, trying to get the facts from him, who sent him there, what was he seeing, how did he feel about it, all that I very soon realized with my past experience, this was quite futile. What we are talking about was something which happened 50 years ago. The man was now about 80. That day in the ghetto was not at that time a tremendous event in his life. In fact, to the point that when he took these snapshots and sent them to his wife, he forgot all about them. And it's only very, very recently, because he's getting old and making order in his drawers, that he discovered these films. So I realized there was not much point interrogate him on that score, because, like all the German prisoners of war under interrogation, he was telling me not what he really remembered or felt, but what he thought I wanted to hear.
What did he tell you?
Well, he told me, now the bare story is that he was known in his group, he was of a very, very humble rank. In his group it was known that he had a camera, and to make himself pocket money, like soldiers do, he used to take snapshots of his colleagues to send home. So his commanding officer knew that he was a photographer, and I think out of sheer curiosity, since the unit was stationed within an earshot of the Warsaw Ghetto, he asked him, gave him a pass, so Willy Georg tells me, and he entered the ghetto and started taking the snapshots. Now, this was not allowed. Photographs other than the official photographs, which were taken on occasions, were not allowed. Now, he was lucky that he roved through the ghetto freely until towards the evening. He was, in fact, apprehended by the German police, who forced him to open the camera and destroy the film that was in it. But he did not tell them, and I put this to his credit, he did not tell them that he already had four rolls in his pocket. Now, after that, he was pushed out of the ghetto, and as he tells me, he went immediately to a photographic studio, a Polish photographic studio outside the ghetto walls, and developed the film. Now, he's terribly, terribly proud of his, and justly so, of his professional competence, that these films, 50 years on, are as crisp, as fresh, as if they were taken yesterday.
Did you have family in the Warsaw Ghetto?
No, I did not have family in the Warsaw Ghetto, because the only surviving member of my family, that is my mother, did in fact survive in Warsaw at that time, but having so-called Aryan papers, that is, pretending not to be Jewish. And she lived not far from the ghetto, and she saw, in fact, ghetto burning, but she was blissfully outside, and she did survive the war. And immediately after the war, well, the war ended in May 1945. In June, I was already in Poland and fetched her with me.
You write at the end of the book, to many of us who grew up within or next to that human landscape and who remember it lovingly, these people, shameful to confess, did not at that time look attractive. These misty eyes, beards, sidelocks, crooked noses. One looked away, embarrassed by what a non-Jewish onlooker might feel or say. Could you expand a little bit about that, on that complicated feeling that you express?
Did I write that? What you read to me, did I write that? How very well put. Well, look, one could write volumes on this. There was a vast section of the population of Jews in Poland who were indistinguishable from the Polish population around them. Assimilated, both in dress, in speech, in interests, in dedication to ideals, differing from the Polish neighbors only by origin, by religion, which they often did not practice anyway. Now then, there was another section of the population which was Orthodox, both in dress, in manners, in interest, and they might just as well have lived in any other country and retained their appearance and habits as they did in Poland. A great many of them, for all I know, of that section, never spoke to a Pole in their lives. They lived within a Jewish society which was self-sufficient, and you could be born and grow up and study and die and marry and have children and be surrounded by Jews alone. There were such large centers of Jews in Poland. And one of them, of course, the largest of all, was in Warsaw. So what we see here in these pictures, these faces, which I then describe somewhere as Rembrandtesque, these bearded with misty eyes, with crooked noses and so on, they do in fact represent this section of the population which I just described.
I think one of the things I find most extraordinary about these photographs is that they're photographs of the exterior life, the quote, normal life, in a place where nothing's normal at all. These are people kind of on the street, going about their business on the street. People who have nothing left, no shoes, no food, no fat left on their bodies. But what you're seeing is the surface. What you're seeing is them walking down the street or standing in front of what used to be a shop.
Well, I think what one has to bear in mind is the timing. We are talking about summer 1941. Now, this is my dating, not Willy Dierok's dating, because I read, the internal evidence of these pictures. Thus, when I see a horse, for instance, on that day, I know that this must have been taken before October 1941, because by October, there were no horses in the ghetto.
Why not?
Well, because they were eaten. So we have to bear in mind this is early days, and there is still in the ghetto a life of sorts. Now, some people don't look hungry, and a great many people at that time were not hungry. A great many were, and all that comes through in the pictures. Let's not forget, the ghetto was only set up in September 1940. We are talking about probably April 1941. Now, in September 1940, I will not say that there were no hungry people at all. The society was so diverse that there were rich and poor, and some of the poor possibly were hungry. But this was not a common phenomenon, that somebody would be hungry. Now, between September 1940, when the ghetto was set up, and April 1941, we already see the advancing ravages of disease and hunger. But this is not yet so far advanced that we would see in these pictures the total horror.
My guest is Raphael Scharf. He's edited a new book of photographs and memoirs called In the Warsaw Ghetto, Summer 1941. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Today is the 50th anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, and my guest is Raphael Scharf. The photographs are accompanied by Warsaw Ghetto diaries that you've chosen.
Yes.
Are these diaries that you found, or are they collected in archives? How did you get them?
No, this is public property. I have no proprietary rights to the diaries. They do exist. Now, what one has to bear in mind is that in one respect, the Germans were very unlucky in the choice of their victims. They chose very literary people. Everybody felt that what was happening was so startling, so unusual, so unbelievable, that it had to be put on record. Now, a great, great many people, since among the Jews there are a great many people who are literate, started writing and putting these things on record. Now, all that might not have reached us if not for the idea and the work of one single person by the name of Emanuel Ringelblum, a historian and sociologist, who had this idea that everything had to be recorded. And he organized a network of people which spread through the country, not only in Warsaw, to write all that they saw, to supply labels, all printed matters, documents which they came across, posters which they stripped off the wall, and brought it to him to form the archives of the ghetto. Now, when the noose started tightening, and he himself, although he and his wife and his son lived at that time hidden outside the ghetto, he felt that his days might be numbered, and he organized a group of people who collected all those archives, that is, all the reports that he received, the posters, the labels, all the written matter by adults and by children, and sealed them in milk churns and steel boxes and buried them under an address which is known to us in Warsaw. Now, virtually everything that we know of what was happening there at the time is due to the materials which come from the Ringelblum archives. Now, these archives were partly, unfortunately only partly, recovered after the war, some of it already in 1945 or 6, some of it in 1950, and the rest is lost.
How is it lost?
Well, it's lost because it's a miracle that this was found. Don't forget, the ghetto was totally, but totally destroyed. And when I first saw it, which was in the ruins of it, in June 1945, when I went to Poland to fetch my mother, there was an enormous mound of rubble, 6 stories high. The streets were unrecognizable. Now, we knew the address, that this was buried under a house in Novolipie Street 43 or some such number. It was not possible to find the house where the street was. Now, slowly, slowly, somehow, the rubble began to be cleared, and some knowledgeable people, and among them somebody who was actually participating in the process of burying, a man called Vassar, led the team to the site where it was buried. And a few milk churns and steel boxes were recovered. Now, they didn't give up. They searched and searched and searched. It took them years. And in 1950, they came upon the further treasure trove. But by that time, the building started rising, and there is some treasure trove over a built-up area under a street or God knows what. Now, that has to be given up for lost. But the diaries that we are speaking of, in their majority, with a few exceptions, I don't know that they are important because, for instance, some diaries were simply smuggled out and preserved. But most of the materials from which I gathered the excerpts come from the Ringelblum archives. Ringelblum archives. This is how the treasure trove is known. The originals are in the Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw, but a full record, a photographic record, has been given to the Yad Vashem institution in Jerusalem, which is the Israeli institution dealing with these matters.
Emanuel Ringelblum, who gathered all these materials, he did not survive the war.
He did not survive. He was denounced, and police came for him and took him. Actually, he did not live. He lived in a in a garden house of a Polish peasant and was taken to the, actually we know that, to the ground of the ghetto and shot with he and his wife and his son. And he, I think, is the great unsung hero of those times.
I wonder if anybody, if you know if anybody in your family kept memoirs during the war.
Look, you speak of my family. Just by a coincidence, you might say, if I'm to speak of my family, the majority of them on my father's side come from a little town not far from Krakow called Oświęcim, which became Auschwitz. Now, in that Oświęcim, which was then accursed with the name Auschwitz, the majority of the population were Jews, and among them, the clan of Scharfs. I have counted myself now from memory, relatives, there were over 50 people whom I listed. Now, among them, there is not a single survivor. They did not have far to go. Now, if you ask me whether any of them kept diaries, they may have done, because they were, on the whole, very literate, being of long rabbinical stock, but they have not reached me.
Well, you have a library of survivors' material in England, a library of diaries and memoirs of survivors. Tell me why you decided to set that up.
Look, this... I'm not alone in this. I'm alive when the rest of them are dead. And I've always felt that duty, that having survived, I owe something to those who have not survived. And how am I to pay that debt other than by cultivating the memory and trying to make those who want to forget not to allow them to forget? So within my modest means, I am no great scholar, I'm immersed, you could say, day and night in those materials to the virtual exclusion of other reading matter, which I think is an enormous impoverishment. But when I take up a book to read for pleasure, I feel that I'm wasting time. I'm not allowed to do it.
Raphael Scharf edited the new book In the Warsaw Ghetto, Summer 1941, published by Aperture. He'll be back with us in the second part of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our talk with Raphael Scharf about the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, which began 50 years ago today. We'll also hear how Scharf got out of Poland just before the German invasion. But his family stayed behind. Most of them died in the Holocaust. And book critic John Leonard reviews new books of stories and essays by German writer Christa Wolf. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Attorney General Janet Reno says she bears responsibility for the decision to go ahead with the operation against the Branch Davidian compound near Waco, Texas. Early this morning, a tank rammed large holes in the walls of the compound and tear gas was fired inside. A few hours later, a fire that officials say was set by cult members destroyed the company's compound, and it appears only 8 people out of the 95 believed inside the compound survived. Reno called today's events an extremely tragic and horrible situation. NPR's Brian Nader reports.
Reno somberly told reporters she approved the plan and said, quote, "I'm responsible for it." President Clinton was informed of the plan for the assault yesterday and gave his consent. Reno, however, said the buck stops with her.
Obviously, if I thought the chances were great of a mass suicide, I would never have approved the plan. Everything that we were told, every indication of the reactions to the pressure up to that point was that there would not, that would not occur.
Reno, just a few weeks into office, said she gave the go-ahead after hearing reports that children were being abused in the compound. In the face of likely congressional investigations and criticism for the action, Reno said she welcomed all questions and denied the situation was mishandled. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
President Clinton continued lobbying for his short-term economic stimulus package today as Republican and Democratic leaders met on Capitol Hill to work out a compromise. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The president has scaled back his stimulus package to $12 billion, but Republicans in the Senate, who've blocked the bill for weeks with a filibuster, weren't budging. Today, a frustrated-sounding President Clinton went before a cheering audience of construction union leaders and once again attacked Republicans for holding up what he's now calling an emergency jobs bill. The White House has moved to counter Republican arguments against the bill, pointing out that what costs Clinton's package would add to the deficit this year are paid for over 5 years, and reminding voters that the same Republican senators voted to spend money on the same kinds of programs throughout the Reagan years. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
According to former President Bush's chief economic advisor, President Clinton's short-term economic stimulus plan is trivial. Michael Boskin told the American Enterprise Institute conference that it's clear that the plan won't be approved in its original form. And if all of it was to pass, it could have only the most trivial short-run stimulus effect and little impact on the nation's economy. He conceded that the economy does have serious problems, including modest job growth. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 11 points to close at 3,466.99. This is NPR News. Retired General John Vesey says that he has doubts about a Russian document indicating North Vietnam held back hundreds of U.S. prisoners of war. He says after 2 days of meetings with officials from Vietnam, he is not ready yet to give a final verdict on the document, which is said to be a Russian translation of a presentation by a North Vietnamese general in 1972. The document found in Russian archives in Moscow indicated that North Vietnam may have held more than 1,200 American prisoners of war when it admitted holding only 368. In the mayor's primary race in Los Angeles, 24 candidates are on tomorrow's ballot. Despite the crowded field, there appears to be 2 candidates likely to make the June runoff election. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
L.A.'s mayoral election is nonpartisan, but the two leading contenders are a lifelong Republican and a liberal Democrat. The Liberal candidate is 41-year-old Michael Wu, an urban planner and two-term member of the city council. He has strong support from all of the city's minority communities and from Liberal whites. It's a coalition similar to the one that kept L.A.'s current mayor, Tom Bradley, in power for 20 years. But coming from far back in the pack to challenge Wu for the lead is 62-year-old Republican Richard Reardon, who has spent $3 million of his own money on his primary campaign. Reardon is often compared to Ross Perot. His business dealings have made him a fortune estimated at $100 million, and he has never before run for elective office. The two candidates receiving the most votes tomorrow face each other in a runoff June 8th. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
In South Africa, millions of workers stayed off the job in mourning for slain black leader Chris Hani. Business groups said at least half the nation's 6 million black workers stayed home in the second major one-day strike in a week. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the Second World War, after the German invasion of Poland, the Jews of Warsaw were forced to live in a ghetto which was walled off from the rest of the city. Today is the 50th anniversary of the start of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, in which Jews resisted the German soldiers who came to destroy the ghetto and the remaining Jews. Back with us is Raphael Scharf, who has edited a new book of photos taken in the ghetto one summer day in 1941. He told me what led to the uprising.
For a long time, the Jews of Warsaw did not realize and did not suspect and could not believe the fate that was awaiting them. But slowly, when the Germans embarked on the so-called resettlement, they let it be known among the Jewish population that trains will arrive on a railway siding in Warsaw, that they will go by those trains, they will go somewhere to the east where their living conditions will be better than those that prevail in Warsaw. And for a longish time, day after day, Jews were either herded or reported voluntarily because there was a reward for rewarding a loaf of bread to the place in Warsaw which was known as Umschlagplatz. Trains were on the siding, they were loaded into the trains, and the trains disappeared. Now, that began to be very, very suspicious because those trains that were supposed to go to the east were back on the sidings within a few hours. Now, the matter was investigated by some courageous people, and it was discovered that those trains were not going to the east, but they were going to a place called Treblinka, which by that time was set up by the Germans as an extermination camp, a death camp, namely, gas ovens were erected, where people were herded and were poisoned by the German invention of Zyklon B, which was a gas-producing chemical. And then their bodies were burned in crematoria and the ashes were thrown onto the open ground. And that went on day by day, night by night, week by week. And hundreds of thousands were thus destroyed. Now, that reached at last the ears of the incredulous population in Warsaw. And some young people, not all that many, we are talking about a few hundred, decided that rather than be destroyed like this, they will raise arms, whatever they could, and they will die like human beings with arms in their hands. Now, the collecting of arms, acquiring of arms, was not simple and was not easy. There was very little of it. But they did manage to get some machine guns, Molotov cocktails, some hand grenades. And on the 19th of April, when the German army entered, as usual they did, to help the herding of the Jews to the Umschlagplatz, they met with armed resistance, much to their astonishment. Now that was the beginning and the first day of the Warsaw Ghetto uprising.
From the journals that you've read, do you think that the armed resistance in the ghetto had any hope that they would win over the Germans and that they would live?
No. Not a trace of it. Nobody had the slightest illusion. We are talking about a disproportion of arms which is so monstrous and overwhelming. None of them, not a single person who joined the fight in the Warsaw Ghetto, had the slightest illusion that they'll survive. Here was a victorious German army armed to the teeth with tanks and flamethrowers and bombs and aeroplanes and God knows what, against literally a handful of Jewish boys armed with Molotov cocktails. Nobody had the slightest illusion. This was a gesture, a suicidal gesture, to die with dignity, which they did.
You reprint a call for resistance, a pamphlet that called for resistance. It was written by the Jewish military organization in the Warsaw Ghetto in January of 1943. Let me just read an excerpt of it. "Let the people awaken to war. Find the courage in your soul for desperate action. Put an end to our terrible acceptance of such phrases as, 'We are all under sentence of death. It is a lie. We also were destined to live. We too have a right to life. One only needs to know how to fight for it. It is no great art to live when life is given to you willingly, but there is an art to life just when they are trying to rob you of this life. Let the people awaken and fight for its life. Let every mother be a lioness defending her young. Let no father stand by and see the blood of his children in silence. Let not the first act of our destruction be repeated, an end to despair and lack of faith, an end to the spirit of slavery amongst us." How was that circulated without it being seen by the Nazis?
Well, this was, first of all, it was duplicated by primitive means because they had no other. And leaflets were distributed. But also they were pasted on the walls. And when you say they were not seen by the Nazis, the ghetto was enclosed. The Nazis penetrated there only through a prescribed route and for a specific purpose. But for a long, long time, they did not care two hoots what was happening to the Jewish community when they were on their own. If anti-German jokes were openly told on street corners, fun was made of them when one could rouse oneself to a smile, because the Jews were left alone by the Germans, knowing that in the end all of them would perish anyway, and it doesn't matter what they say and what they think and what they do. So the material distributed in the ghetto was not... The Germans didn't care. They didn't look for it.
My guest is Raphael Scharf, editor of the new book, In the Warsaw Ghetto, Summer 1941. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. This is the 50th anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. My guest is Raphael Scharf. Can I ask how you got out of Poland during the war?
Well, no, I didn't. No, I came down. I came to England just before the war. I left Poland before the war. I was a foreign correspondent to a Polish-Jewish newspaper in Krakow, and I came to London already in 1938. So that's one more reason. I was not really a part of it. All my burden that I carry is the burden of an absentee. I was not there myself.
How did you know to get out?
I didn't. I got out. Lots of people got out. I didn't get out because had I known what was happening, I would have got out, not only myself, but I would have carried my family with me, perhaps. No, I had no idea what will happen. And although in retrospect it looks almost silly to say that one didn't know the war was coming, it was not all that obvious. I came to England. I was struck by this enormous power of the British Empire. And since this was for all the world to see, didn't Hitler see this? Would he dare? That's how it looked at that time. Now, in retrospect, it looks silly. But I did not get out of Poland because I thought that the war was coming. Had I known that the war was coming, I would think twice about getting out.
You got out for professional reasons?
For professional reasons. Also, I was a little bit tired of life in Poland. I saw wide horizons. And if truth be told, I saw England, as it were, as a staging post only in my journey to Palestine, where I wanted to land eventually.
Can you tell us a little bit more what it was like the first time you went back to Poland?
Now, the first time I went back was, as I mentioned before, it was in June 1945, because I received news from the first emissary who came from Krakow that there are a few Jews left, or few Jews who came back to Krakow already when the war ended, and that my mother is among them. Whereupon, I didn't think twice. I was at that time in the British Army. Details won't matter. I've organized myself transport, and I drove hell for leather day and night until I came to Krakow and knocked at my mother's door.
And she was home?
She was waiting for me. I would not have come without warning her because she would not have survived the shock. She knew that I was on the way. And often I took her with me. She lived with us still in London for 10 years. And I spent those 10 years, you could say, at her bedside, where she was telling me endlessly her story. And therefore, I feel I had sort of first-hand evidence from an eyewitness immediately after.
And what you've been doing ever since is collecting stories of other people.
Well, look, this is not terribly relevant to what we are saying, because I say I was collecting stories. This is not and could not have been my full-time job. I had to earn a living. So even though this is a lifelong interest, I led a normal life, and I have a family and a wife and children and grandchildren, and on the face of it, live a life which is indistinguishable from that of my neighbor.
What are some of the thoughts that come to your mind on this 50th anniversary of the start of the uprising?
I would like this to be remembered. I very often have the feeling that the memory of it only surfaces on anniversaries. But I think that it is necessary to know what had happened, how it happened, who was responsible for it, and what was lost in the process. I think it's necessary to remember it all the time.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Raphael Scharf edited the new book In the Warsaw Ghetto, Summer 1941, featuring photographs of the ghetto and passages from ghetto diaries. It's published by Aperture. This is music composed by Gideon Klein while he was in the concentration camp Theresienstadt. This is Fresh Air. Today, Americans watch the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, burn. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what are you going to have on that on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll be talking with NPR's John Burnett, who's in Waco, about the confrontation and the fire there today. Also, we'll talk with Tom Jelton, who's in Tuzla in Bosnia, about the fall of Srebrenica in eastern Bosnia, the UN air evacuation of the wounded and sick, and negotiations that continue about what amounts to a one-sided disarmament. I'll talk with a woman who 50 years ago was helping send coded messages from Warsaw about the beginning of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, Sylvia Pagioli, on the elections in Italy, and an update on the mayor's race in Los Angeles. The primary election is tomorrow.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The German writer Christa Wolff has been as important to the former East Germany as Günter Grass has been to the former West Germany. She was born in 1929 and has written several memoirs and novels, including No Place on Earth, The Quest for Christa T, and Cassandra. Currently, Wolff is a scholar in residence at the Getty Center for the History of Art and the Humanities in Santa Monica, California. Critic John Leonard has a review of her two new books, What Remains and Other Stories, and The Author's Dimension.
When Christa Wolff's remarkable Cassandra was published in this country, it was two books in one. It was a novel from the point of view of the clairvoyant priestess hostage, who knew in advance exactly how the Trojan War would turn out. And it was a series of lectures on why the author needed to write such a novel, what her thinking had been on patriarchal drama since the Greeks, the blood-red thread of narrative, the hero plot, and the epic quest of men for turf and glory, at the expense of the choral songs of women about seasons and renewal. These abrasions of fact on fiction rubbed up something combustible. By the light of fiery sparks, the novel seemed to have more facets and a shadowy inner life, while the lectures, needing some passion for their abstraction, had only to look next door at all that death to prove themselves. I think this new collection of Wolff's stories from 1960 to 1979 and this new selection of her essays from 1964 to 1990 might also have profited from a mingling and a weaving in chronological order in one big book without regard to which is fact and which is fiction. Thus, almost simultaneously, we could experience her two ways of thinking as she moved from a guilt-stricken child of the Hitler years to a dutiful East German communist to a pacifist, a feminist, and a dissident. In her essays, Wolff bounces, as if the occasion were a trampoline. In her stories, she dreams, always suspicious of the code in which your dreams are written, their secret cipher. What happens matters less than the way we remember it. I'd like to be able to turn from what she says about literature, socialism, the Berlin Wall, Thomas Mann, Max Frisch, and Caroline von Gunderode, who figured so prominently in No Place on Earth, to how she dreams about the end of war and the end of childhood in 1945, a day in the life of a provincial town, walking down Berlin's most famous avenue, a helicopter in a garden, and being watched by the secret police. Through such binoculars, we would see the shape-changing of a fierce intelligence as it clarifies itself. I won't tell you these books are required reading, not if you haven't already read her novels. But literary criticism right now is irrelevant. Wolf is under ferocious attack in a reunited Germany for having been a state poet of the old regime who stayed when she could have fled west, for having opposed One Big Germany after the wall came down, for writing the title story of What Remains, which is about the secret police, back in 1979, but not publishing it till 1990. And because of last January's disclosure that for a couple of years in the early 60s, she actually met and talked to the secret police. Okay, none of these critics was braver than she at the time, and none as outspoken from the mid-60s on. None has ever gone to see a movie like The Sorrow and the Pity and wondered how they themselves might have behaved. None is a pacifist or a feminist, and none has written a book half as good as anything by Christa Wolf. So she wasn't a Václav Havel. She behaved exactly like Boris Pasternak in Russia and George Conrad in Hungary. She wrote an allegory like the Latin American magic realists, or for the secret drawer like Filipino playwrights and Chinese mysties and the poets of Persia. To see her stabbed in the back by pygmies with ballpoint pens makes me heartsick.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed two new books by Christa Wolf, What Remains and Other Stories, and The Author's Dimension. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Vablaitis and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet a Tibetan Lama. Sogyal Rinpoche grew up in a Tibetan monastery. After the Chinese invasion of Tibet, he fled with his teachers and family. Now he lives in England and lectures on Buddhism around the world. He's written a new book for Westerners interpreting Tibetan teachings on life and death. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.